This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, a conversation with Indiana economist, writer, and speaker Morton Marcus. He's put out a number of his Eye on the Pie columns recently, and we'll talk with Morton about those and the topics he brings up. We'll also have an interesting topic from this week's Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. It centers around the community of Miller in Gary. And we'll also bring you as well a conversation with Professor Jeffrey Herron with the Valparaiso University School of Law. They have an interesting project coming up next Thursday, a screening of a documentary in dealing with immigration, and a panel discussion that follows at that session next Thursday. From time to time, we check in with noted Indiana economist, writer, and speaker Morton Marcus. He puts out a column that's entitled Eye on the Pie on a regular basis. And one of the columns that have come out in recent weeks here is certainly poignant and pertinent even now. We were talking, he was writing about the disaster that happened in Houston, and now we know it's expanded with another hurricane across Florida. Morton, thanks for being with us today. And if you will, tell us a little bit about how the column that you put out recently that deals with the issues around the disaster in Houston certainly could probably be just as pertinent to South Florida and out to other sections of Florida as Hurricane Irma has moved through after the Hurricane Harvey came through Texas.
Well, what we have are what we consider natural disasters, but a lot of it really is helped along as a disaster by the kinds of decisions that we've made in the past. And the question to me is, we shouldn't be making those same bad choices in the future. Let me give you an example. Okay. Houston has not built its tremendous growth with an eye toward the fact that they have very heavy rains there all the time. And they are subject to these unusual events we call hurricanes. They should have built better to handle the water problems that they have. In Florida, we see a wonderful example where Miami's damage has been much less, not because it got less wind and less water this time, but because they have built better since Hurricane Andrew more than a decade ago. And we've got to think the same way right here in Indiana. We talk about, oh, it's terrible. We get tornadoes come through here. Well, we've had tornadoes come through and destroy large parts of many of our communities. But when we rebuild, we basically rebuild what we had, as though what we had was what is desirable. And in many cases, I think that's wrong. I think about downtown Frankfurt, which was largely destroyed by a tornado coming through many, many years ago. And it was rebuilt in the same manner that it had been 40, 60 years earlier. We've got to think in much more contemporary terms about what we already know. We've had problems in Lake County in handling water. A heavy rain or something would come through, and we'd have sewers backing up because we didn't have proper infrastructure. The time's come to update what we've done in the past to protect ourselves from these natural events. And we spend so much money on so many other things that I would say are unnecessary. Consumers obviously disagree with me, but there's a lot of just to give you an example and make enemies, I think we spend much too much money on our children. I think we spend too much money on giving them toys. We spend too much money on their activities. I think we spend too much money on jewelry for men and women. Men's jewelry is maybe not as obvious, but you look at the watches that some men wear, and it is just unbelievable that they're spending that kind of money. I would put a large amount of excise taxes on these things, and people will scream, but the point is we've got to stop them from crying in the future.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to see maybe if such an excise tax was imposed that some of that should go be allocated for certain expansion, I guess, of public expansion, that is, of ways to be able to deal better with disasters like flooding and the like?
Precisely. That's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see a lot of it spent at the local level. I think it's inappropriate that we go in with federal funds to rebuild communities when we need to completely change many of those communities because they are not built with the natural environment in mind. And you know, I'm not arguing on behalf of tree huggers. I'm not an environmentalist as such. What I'm saying is, let's spend our money wisely. And we don't spend our money wisely. There are so many things that we need that we all need in a community. And I'd like to see much more local spending, local taxes, or taxes from the federal level that come back to the local level for building the kind of infrastructure that we need. How many streets flood or underpasses flood during a big rainstorm? And then we hear about cars getting stuck in them and sometimes people dying in those cars. That shouldn't happen. We should be prepared for much more serious rain than we have been in the past. We built sort of a minimalist world in terms of protecting ourselves. How well are our houses built for tornadoes? Tornadoes are very common in Indiana, yet we have large numbers of people who are living in travel trailers or mobile homes. That's mm-hmm. the word I was looking right. for. In mobile homes, and they're not appropriately tied down. Or the structural building. We build a lot of mobile homes in Indiana. What do we need to do to make them stronger so that they can withstand the problems? I don't know about the roof on your house, but I think about the roof on my house. And what should we have built when this house was built to make that roof stronger? Well, I'm not saying we go back and we refit every old home, but I do think we have to start thinking about everything new that we built to build to a new and higher standard.
One of the other interesting columns that I wanted to bring up, Morton, was one that was not out, was put out not too long ago here, talking about land use, and you kind of tie it together with the importance of what the job of a mayor of a community is, and it's interesting that how you fit this in together, and a lot of this, of course, proper land use is something that a mayor does have to consider.
That's right, and one of the problems that we have is that mayors keep their nose out of land use issues because it's highly political. Mm-hmm. It's generally the neighborhood against some business, and if the mayor comes out in favor of the business, then the people say, "Oh, he's selling out." And if he comes out in favor of the neighborhood, he or she, I should say, then the view is, well, the mayor's just being political and going where the votes are. The mayor should be thinking in terms of 15 and 20 years ahead, which is very difficult to do. We have a lot of good mayors in Indiana, and I've talked to many, many of them, who are thinking about today. How do I do my job about today better? And they really don't think about who's going to be mayor 15 years from now, and what kinds of decisions are they going to have to make because of the decisions I ignore today? Mm-hmm. It's a very difficult job, but being mayor has a different responsibility from what many mayors see. They see their job as making sure that the streets get cleared of snow. That's very important, but they've got to think beyond that. They've got to really think about the future. To me, that's a very important example. If I could take an example of a mayor I know mm-hmm. who did do that, who was concerned about making sure the streets were clear of snow, and at the same time thinking about the future, and that would be the former mayor of Hammond. I'm getting old, so names don't come back to mind as easily as they should. But he also built that wonderful golf course that we've got in the northern part of Hammond.
The Lost Marsh.
Dwayne Marsh, and it's Dwayne Dedalo is the man I have in mind.
That's right.
That building that golf course and using funds in that way was just a marvelous transformation of land use. And he was thinking about the future, and he was thinking about the future of the school children of Hammond. It's a brilliant example of a mayor doing both jobs.
Maybe he's taking in this case, Mayor Dedalo was taking what used to be a landfill and improperly using it for a better use, that is for a golf course.
Right, and getting rid of a polluted site and making something that's really very beneficial to the people of Hammond and to the entire community. I think it was a wonderful example, and he's not the only one, but there's an example of what I'm talking about. We have one of the worst problems in the state of Indiana in the northern part of Lake County, because we have so much old, deteriorated buildings. We have so much pollution. The mayors of Gary successively have been trying to tear down and restore land. They haven't been able to attract the investment as yet, but that's going to come. And every time I see a building come down in Gary, I say, here's a mayor who's thinking about the future, not only improving the current situation, but also thinking about the future. That, to me, is so important. Preparing the land, lowering the cost of using that land in the future. And many people say, oh, it's terrible, they're tearing down all the old buildings. Those buildings generally need to come down, and we need to think about the subsequent use of that land.
We're talking with Indiana economist, writer and speaker Morton Marcus on his columns, Eye on the Pie, that come out regularly. In fact, one of the latest that came out this week here was dealing with, immigrants in particular, but how Indiana counties fit into the picture of this, what is known as the American Community Survey, which is, I guess, a U.S. Census document. Is very dull and boring, but there are a lot of interesting things that can be gleaned from that document sometimes. And I know that you use that, and in fact, you've used that in particular for the subject of three columns recently. But the latest one in particular that came out on Monday talks about how people, in turn, I guess, communities attracting people that are needed here. But how does the American Community Survey fit in together with, with immigrants and the people that we're seeing move into Indiana the most?
Well, the survey tells us where people have come from. And that's very important to get an idea of whether our community is attracting young people. You'll excuse my dog in the background.
Oh, there he
is. Excited, I believe, because his mother is coming home.
Oh, yeah.
His mother is also known as my wife. I've put him out in the garage with my wife. I didn't put my wife in the garage. She put herself there.
She's in the car still, I suppose, yes.
Yes, that's right. What the survey does is it gives us an idea of who came from where. And I've been able to look at it by age. And it's really quite interesting. As everyone knows, but now is confirmed by the statistics, Lake County has been attracting a lot of people from Illinois. And that shows up very clearly in the survey. Lake County has not been attracting older people. And this, to me, is one of the opportunities that we have. We have a lot of people who have retired in the past, who worked in Lake County and lived in Lake County. They could possibly be attracted to retirement communities in Lake County. But we haven't really seen, from my understanding, any real investment in retirement communities in Lake County that are designed to bring back those factory workers who made good money and then moved to Florida. And this is true all across Indiana, where we've had factory workers who have just moved away. Well, they've moved to a place that we now see is really a dangerous place to live. Very uncomfortable. I have quite a few Lake County friends who have moved to Florida, and I've been in touch with them. I'm glad to say they've come through the most recent storm, Irma, without difficulty. But it's a tough life in many respects, and they might be much happier being back in an environment that they know and where there are friends that they've had in the past. But we haven't made that kind of investment. The private sector hasn't built that a kind of attractive residential community. Oh, you know, the Del Webb type of retirement facilities.
Right.
We just don't have any in Lake County. We don't have any in Porter County that I know of. We've got a here and there a building that is identified as a retirement community. But we're talking about people who've got better than average savings, people who have lots of reminiscences about Lake and Porter County, and they might be attracted back. But Lake County hasn't been attracting them.
Well, I would think that after the recent disasters with the hurricanes Harvey and Irma, that we should probably rethink this idea of finding a stable and attractive housing for seniors, more than just someplace for people who are not well to stay, maybe in their final months or years of life. They should be looking into more positive, certainly, senior living facilities. And the places that are around and the people that have got such facilities in mind, certainly we've got the green light. I would say that after enough of the natural disasters that we've gone through here just in the last month, that should take a real serious look at this again. So we've got some other topics.
Absolutely.
Some other great topics to come up. We want to bring up for our next conversation, Morton. We've kind of run out of time for today. Morton Marcus is a well-noted Indiana economist, writer, and author of the topics and a speaker of these topics as well on the Indiana economic scene. And as always, Morton, thank you for spending some time with us to cover some of these topics. And we'll be back again real soon.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity, Chris.
You're listening to
Regionally Speaking. Talk to you later.
Thank you. Take care. We're talking with Morton Marcus here on Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio.
Each month, we get billed for streaming services for music, movies, and TV shows. We get boxes full of cool pop culture stuff and pet toys. We even get clothes all picked out for us. But what about radio? You turn on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and it's there. No monthly fees, no paywalls, just free, non-biased radio. How does that work? Well, without getting into the engineering components, it's simple. With your tax-deductible donations, you make a pledge, and we pledge to bring you local, state, and national news every day. Whether you donate $10 one time or $10 a month, you're helping to sustain Lakeshore Public Radio. And when you make a pledge online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, there's still no paywall, just the news and information that you've come to rely on for nearly 9 years. Our fall membership campaign is underway, and we need your support to help close the gap and make Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM sustainable. Head over to lakeshorepublicradio.org and click on the donate button to make a tax-deductible donation right now. Thank you for your support.
Program support comes from NIPSCO. It's wise to not stand in front of the refrigerator with the door wide open. Visit NIPSCO.com/savemore to find many more ways to cut energy costs in your kitchen.
This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs them with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Gary was the place you went to shop, and when it was a very successful community. We either drove there, my parents drove us there, or when we got a little older, we would just take the bus to downtown Gary. And there was every kind of shop you could think of. And at Christmas time, it was shoulder to shoulder walking up to down the street doing Christmas shopping. It was thriving. I grew up in a Lake Station, which it was East Gary when I grew up in it. And originally, it was Lake Station back in the 1800s and early 1900s. And then They changed their name to East Gary when, you know, the mills were starting to go and they wanted the executives to move there, so they changed it. Then when things got bad in Gary, they changed it back to Lake Station. I thought that is very telling. It was a typical suburban kind of neighborhood. It was very working class. In fact, there were going to high school there. Everybody's parents made about the same amount of money. They worked in the mills. So in that way, it was probably different than a lot of other places because none of us were aspiring to be the rich kid in school. There were no rich kids in school. Patrick and I were married in 1966, and we moved to Miller in 1967, and we moved with a young baby. At that time, Miller was thriving. The downtown area had every kind of store you can think of. It was jewelry stores and bookstores and coffee shops and dress shops and Jack Spratt's ice cream shop, which was drew people from all over. And it was the funnel to the beach. I mean, hundreds of people would come to the beach during the summer from all over. It started to change really in the 70s. And with so many things, early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, with all of the things that were going on nationally and locally, you know, the war had an impact on the economy, the Vietnam War. The mills were at their heights and then started, you know, the economy was changing, the technology was changing so that less people were needed in the mills. And the whole suburban sprawl had an impact on little downtowns like Miller. It happened everywhere in the country, and it certainly happened here in Indiana with the other small communities. So at some point, there weren't a lot of businesses on the street, and those that were weren't thriving. A lot of the people left. They moved to Munster. That's how Munster got built. And the people who stayed are still here. But the whole dynamics of the community changed. The money went with them. You know, Munster's a thriving town. Maryville is in much better shape than Gary. So, yeah, that's the impact. If Gary doesn't thrive, the rest of the area doesn't thrive. And I think that is critically important. We can't have part of our population barely surviving. The city of Gary has all the infrastructure, you know, the steel mills. It has so much going for it. We can't ignore it. It's like somebody in your family who has cancer and you're just going to ignore them because it's not going to affect you. Well, it is going to affect you. We all need to be good neighbors, and it's not just in Gary and Lake County, but in Porter County in Indiana. As a country, we have to not be so polarized because nobody's moving ahead.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. White rates continue to climb across the country. Breastfeeding push oftentimes seems to miss black women. Side Effects Public Media's Sarah Fenton asks, what's behind the usual breastfeeding gap?
In a big green park on Indianapolis's south side, a gaggle of people, mostly women, are celebrating. It looks like a birthday party.
Put ice in those.
This is the Indiana Black Breastfeeding Coalition, a group trying to narrow the breastfeeding gap. And instead of celebrating a birthday, they're celebrating breastfeeding.
You have chips, too.
Hi, I'm Tawi Spicer, T as in Tom, A-H-W-I-I.
Spicer, who works with IBBC, is all about being natural. She gave an unmedicated birth to her son at home and says almost as soon as he was born, he started feeding right away.
He literally just army crawled right up to it and he was so ravenous, like he was hungry.
Now she wants to help others learn. Despite her positive experience, Spicer says examples of breastfeeding are sometimes hard to find in the black community. And experts say community history is a big indicator of whether or not women will breastfeed.
We don't always necessarily see our sisters and aunts breastfeeding or cousins, or we might not have even been breastfed ourselves.
According to state data, in 2015, 14% fewer black women than white women left the hospital breastfeeding. That disparity has real health ramifications for Black babies in particular. Research strongly suggests a correlation between breastfeeding and lower rates of certain diseases, including sudden infant death syndrome and life-threatening infections often associated with premature and low birth weight babies. All those are conditions more common in Black infants. So why doesn't a culture of Black breastfeeding exist in the same way it does in, for example, Hispanic women? Erica Anstey, a nutrition scientist at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, says a whole host of disparities add to the gap. There's economics.
Black mothers tend to go back to work earlier.
A white-collar, blue-collar divide.
We know there are a lot of barriers in the workplace in terms of supporting moms to be able to pump.
Also, Black women have babies younger than white women, and data shows younger moms are less likely to begin breastfeeding. Also,
so not all hospitals are providing best maternity care practices that support breastfeeding.
Data backs this up. The CDC found babies born in hospitals in predominantly Black zip codes were much more likely to be offered formula. And Anstey says a lot of hospitals aren't teaching breastfeeding practices in the first place. Experts say America's ugly history of slavery also plays a role. Many times enslaved Black women were forced to breastfeed white babies, often at the expense of their own children. And that history serves as a powerful inherited incentive to view breastfeeding negatively.
Breastfeeding wouldn't become a first priority. We just want to feed our baby.
That's Paris Curtis, a founding member of the Indiana Black Breastfeeding Coalition. She says the first order of business is dealing with a culture that's sometimes unsupportive.
You know, what grandma says, if our husband wants us to. So we don't really have that that connection right off.
That's what this group in the park is doing. IBBC hopes to create change by building a supportive community. It hooks new moms up with mentors through a Bosom Buddies program and puts on drop-in classes and support groups each month. The organization also educates families and dads. Teaching them breastfeeding isn't shameful. It's natural and healthy. Ultimately, Curtis says, it's about removing as many obstacles as possible to make the practice not feel like a burden.
A pleasure, yes. A commitment that you want to make to love your baby and nurture your baby.
For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Sarah Fenton.
Coming up Thursday, September 14th, at the Valparaiso University School of Law, it was going to be the screening of a documentary entitled Documented, involving immigration. And then following that's going to be a panel discussion, of which our next guest is going to be the moderator. Jeffrey Herron is an associate professor of law at Valparaiso University School of Law, and he is with us to talk about not only the presentation itself, but the discussions going to follow. Professor Herron, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit first about Undocumented, how the film got started, the thinking behind it, and certainly how poignant it is in all of the discussion these days with the latest involving DACA and just the overall administration campaign to set up a different immigration policy.
Documented. It's a film that was released in 2013, actually, but it's, for the reasons you mentioned, extremely timely today. In 2011, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jose Antonio Vargas actually outed himself as an undocumented immigrant in an essay in the New York Times magazine. He had been a very successful journalist for the Washington Post and some other papers, and when he did this, it was a big deal, and the reason why he did it was to draw attention to the plight of undocumented people in the country, and the film is basically his story of how he came to the United States, what his life was like, the choices he made, why he made those choices. And it's also a story of the larger struggle, civil rights struggle, really, of undocumented people, particularly those who were brought here at a young age to have some basic dignity and to have a pathway towards citizenship.
Now, I understand that Mr. Vargas was born in the Philippines, and then he came over here as a child. And so certainly the drama with DACA these days certainly is very, very key to the, I guess, understanding of all the problems involving immigration policy.
Right. So he was brought here by his grandparents. He did not make a choice to come here illegally, and that's the case for many children. And there's really a bipartisan consensus, I think, on the part of many in Washington that these folks who are kind of colloquially known as the Dreamers ought to have some sort of pathway towards citizenship. There's been an act that's been It's been submitted in Congress, I think, 12 or more times at this point, called the DREAM Act, that would create just that sort of pathway to citizenship. Lindsey Graham and Senator Durbin are co-sponsors of the current version. And because that act was submitted so many times and never actually passed, President Obama in 2012 created a sort of quasi-status as an exercise of his executive discretion, which was called DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It's not a law. What it really was a statement on his part that he wasn't going to prioritize the deportation of these kids, since so many people agreed that they ought to have some sort of pathway to citizenship, and since there was a likelihood that Congress eventually would act in their favor. Now, Jose Antonio Vargas was a big proponent of the DREAM Act and of DACA, but ironically, he was unable to take advantage of DACA because he was 1 year, I believe, too old, or just a little bit too old, in order to take advantage of it. So he remains undocumented today. He never received DACA. About 800,000 people did receive DACA, and as you mentioned, I think at the start of the call, President Trump and his Attorney General Jefferson Sessions did rescind DACA last week, and as a result, it will be phased out over the next 6 months, and those 800,000 people who received it are now basically in the same position that Jose Antonio Vargas was when he found that he wasn't going to qualify for it.
Now, the screening of Documented is going to happen, as we mentioned earlier, on Thursday, September 14th. It's going to be at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And following the screening of the documentary, we're going to have a panel discussion with you as the moderator talking about immigration enforcement. Tell us, if you will, about the colleagues that are going to be on the panel and what you hope to be able to bring forth in this as moderator and them as the panel participants.
It's a really terrific panel of folks who have a variety of different perspectives on this issue and are coming from different backgrounds. We have Judge Robert D. Vinicourt, who retired as an immigration judge last spring. At the time that he retired, he was the longest-serving immigration judge in the United States. The immigration judges are those who adjudicate deportation cases. And before that, he had a background in various other types of immigration government service as well. So he brings a perspective of government service and having overseen for many years a court handling deportation cases. And he's going to be speaking about the immigration enforcement system and adjudication system. We have Carla Lopez-Owens, who actually is a recent law graduate and going to be a practicing attorney soon. But before that, she co-founded the Indiana Undocumented Youth Alliance, and she is going to be speaking about her experience as a grassroots advocate on this issue concerning the rights of the undocumented, much like Jose Antonio Vargas. And then we have Mark Fleming, who is the National Litigation Coordinator at the National Migrant Justice Center, which is a major nonprofit immigrant rights advocacy group located, headquartered in Chicago, but with offices around the country. And he has been a part of a number of advocacy efforts concerning immigrant rights, such as, for example, the passage recently of the Illinois Trust Act, which limits in some ways law enforcement, state law enforcement cooperation with ICE enforcement efforts, immigration enforcement efforts in the state, neighboring state of Illinois. So yeah. It should be a terrific panel.
Well, certainly sounds that there's some very, very key people here. And I particularly know, too, in the information here that Mrs. Lopez-Owens is a native of Mexico. So she brings a personal perspective to this as well, too, and in addition to all of her law studies in Indiana and elsewhere.
Yes, she has a very poignant personal story. I didn't want to try to relate it for her because it's her story, and I want people to come out and hear about her experiences. I think that she's going to provide a firsthand perspective on this issue that I think a lot of people will find really interesting to hear.
It's certainly worth coming over on Thursday the 14th at 4 o'clock in the afternoon to see the screening of Documented, as well as listen in on the panel discussion. How much work was involved in getting all of this set up, Professor Herron, and getting the screening of this documentary as well as the panelists together that you're going to moderate?
The staff at Valparaiso University did an excellent job of putting this together. I was really kind of a consultant. I did help recruit some of the speakers, and that wasn't too much work, to be honest, because I think all of them were very willing to generously share their time. So for my part, it was relatively easy, but I know that other people worked really hard on it. And I think because of their hard work, it's going to be a great event.
Did it turn out that this was fortuitous, that this topic should be so important, and particularly the issue of DACA and it, with young undocumented immigrants, aliens, as some are referring to them, coming into the United States? It just has happened at this time of not only the administration's efforts to create some kind of big change in policy from the Obama administration.
Of course, immigration is often in the news, but the last week has been a really big week in terms of the rescission of DACA. It's, I think, in some ways a very sad moment to be starting this conversation. No matter what side of the political spectrum you're on, I hope that you would feel sympathetic for these kids who, many of them, are extremely talented. And so it's in some ways a very poignant way for us to start our discussion in kind of a sad moment. But I think it adds some gravitas and some importance to what we're talking about on Thursday.
Professor Jeffrey Herron is an associate professor of law at Valparaiso University School of Law. And if you would like more information and you'd like to be able to register, because the seating is limited for this event next Thursday, the 14th, you can go on to valpo.edu/law/documented and find out more information and be able to register for attending the screening of the documentary, as well as attending the panel discussion afterwards. Professor Herron, thank you very much for spending time today. We hope that people do sign up to get in for this very interesting and very limited availability event, and that people enjoy not only what they hear and see from the documentary, but have a chance to take away something as well, too, in the discussion that's going to follow. And we thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about it today.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
This September 14th screening of Documented and the panel discussion that follows will be held at Weisman Hall, which is the home for the Valparaiso University School of Law. And it's at 656 South Greenwich Street, which is on the west end of the Valparaiso University campus. Local faith leaders met in Indianapolis this week on the anniversary of 9/11 to talk about how churches should respond after an emergency. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Drew Dodlin reports that the project comes from a national group which is called the Christian Emergency Network.
The Readiness Project is an effort to organize and strengthen church efforts after a disaster, anything from a car accident to a terrorist attack to a hurricane. A small group of leaders from the Christian and Muslim community met to talk about bringing the project to Indianapolis. Troy Riggs leads the Sagamore Institute, the conservative think tank that hosted the gathering. Riggs says it supports the idea of an emergency operations center, where staff would function as emergency expert mediators between various faith groups.
It could come to the point that one mosque has room for people, but not the capacity to fix food, but a church has food and can take that food to the mosque or vice versa. That's the type of coordination we need in the emergency.
Riggs, the former Indianapolis police chief, says it's important not to rely entirely on the government to respond quickly and effectively to large-scale disasters. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Drew Dublin.
Farmers in Indiana and across the nation are using more of a powerful but controversial weed killer this year. It easily drifts into neighboring fields and damages crops. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Nick Jansen reports that farmers are used to dealing with drifting herbicides, but find out that there's concern, especially this year, compared to last year.
Farmers have used the herbicide dicamba since at least the 1960s, mostly on corn. Last year, though, the Environmental Protection Agency approved a new type of dicamba to use on cotton and soybean plants genetically engineered to resist the weed killer. Lebanon farmer Don Lamb says the new dicamba has created a problem.
The part that's new is the fact that you could be spraying a soybean and the field next to you looks very similar to what you have, but it's not, because the genetics of that soybean are different.
Dicamba kills soybeans not engineered to tolerate it. And farmers across the country say the new formulation drifts very easily. In Indiana alone, there's been 121 dicamba-related drift complaints since the end of August. Millions of acres have been damaged nationwide. Still, while the product is tricky to use, there's a need for it. Weeds are increasingly resistant to glyphosate, a weed killer more commonly known as Roundup.
That is an example of a weed that is resistant to glyphosate. That's partly why.
Out there.
Yeah. Those are sprayed at a time when they should have died, and they didn't.
Companies producing these new soybeans, such as Monsanto and DuPont, say if farmers follow the directions on the dicamba label, there's no problem with drift. But Lamb says it's not that simple. The label is actually a small book, and there's a website to read on top of that.
That's my responsibility. As a farmer, as an applicator, I need to do it just the way the label says. And if that label's too tight, too restrictive, don't use the product.
Another way to reduce risk, says Red Gold Agriculture Director Steve Smith, is education.
It was surprising. It's very gratifying to think that everybody worked together and communicated between neighbors to help prevent those types of issues, because they were certainly happening all over the state. And so for us to have not had any issues, I feel really good about that. People worked hard to try to prevent the problems.
Tomatoes are also highly susceptible to dicamba damage, and with Red Gold's crop worth $10,000 per acre, the company was sure to work with its neighbors. But Smith says education may not be enough.
Well, I think the science of the matter is pointing very clearly to the fact that the atmospheric conditions and the characteristics of the chemistry itself are going to mean that a certain percentage of the time the conditions are going to be just right for it to move where it's not supposed to go.
Indiana's Pesticide Review Board regulates weed killers. Prior to this year's growing season, it hoped there wouldn't be a need for tighter dicamba rules at all. But Dave Scott, Pesticide Administrator for the Office of the State Chemist, says it hasn't turned out that way. His office has received an unusually high number of complaints this year, and it takes months of field and lab work to determine if dicamba was involved in one.
If we found out just everybody's sloppy and doesn't follow the label, well, then there's a chance to fix that by cracking down on the applicator. If everybody did everything legally but bad stuff still happened, then you have to look at, do there need to be more restrictions on the use that would prevent the bad stuff from happening?
Indiana regulators could require applicators to keep more detailed records about how they use the weed killer. And the EPA recently announced it's considering a cutoff date for dicamba use next growing season, something Red Gold also advocates for. Monsanto, for its part, has said that isn't necessary. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Nick Jansen.
President Abraham Lincoln looms large in our nation's history, and for that very reason, many states lay claim to Lincoln as part of their own history. But as it turns out, there's a reason why Abraham Lincoln may have been more of a Hoosier than most people think.
If you think of where Lincoln grew up, what do you picture? Probably a log cabin like the one Mike Capps is standing near. Capps is at the Lincoln Boyhood National Memorial in Spencer County, Indiana, where he works as the Chief of Interpretation and Resource Management. And today, he's talking about the memorial's namesake.
We're at the Lincoln Living Historical Farm here at Lincoln Boyhood National Memorial. This is an area where we talk about the pioneer life of Abraham Lincoln, his early years in Indiana.
Lincoln spent those years in Spencer County. He moved there in 1816, the year Indiana became a state. Indiana State Museum curator Dale Ogden says Lincoln's story is like many pioneers of the time.
It was a difficult life trying to eke out a living on the frontier. And Indiana was the American frontier during the time that the Lincolns lived in the state.
But the 14 years Lincoln spent as a Hoosier adds confusion over who is able to claim the 16th president as their own. Kentucky is the birthplace of Lincoln. Illinois is the land of Lincoln. Indiana, the boyhood home of Lincoln.
The 14 years that he spent in Indiana, you can say Lincoln boyhood home, but what does that mean? Does it mean he lived here for 2 years? Does it mean he lived here for 20 years? Did he come when he was 2? Did he come when he was 15?
Lincoln's bench mallet is one of the few artifacts that remain from his time in Indiana. Picture a block of wood warped and misshapen from years of splitting logs in half. The not-yet president added a handle and even carved the initials AL to mark his tool.
He just repositioned the handle, cut the handle down, repositioned it, and put it into the groove, and made a mallet out of it for driving pegs, which is essentially what he did for his father, who was a master carpenter.
On the frontier, pioneers like the Lincolns would have used tools until they were no longer usable or refashioned them into something else. What is left is few and far between, like several cabinets built by Abraham's father, Thomas. And although his things may be hard to stumble across, you can still find his family here. Megan Fernandez's great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was Josiah Lincoln, uncle to Abraham. She's one of Lincoln's closest living relatives, the president's first cousin, seven times removed.
We knew, and my mom's family is named Lincoln, so I had a Grandma Lincoln, and, you know, that was the name of my cousins and my uncles.
Fernandez grew up in southern Indiana and remembers one moment when she visited the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum in Springfield, Illinois, and saw a statue of Lincoln. She saw her family's features in his face.
This isn't just like that I have a connection to this person. He's one of my family members. He's not, to me, primarily a president of the United States. He's my cousin right here.
Getting people to see Lincoln as a real person rather than a figure in our country's history is all a part of Capps' job at the National Memorial. He thinks more efforts to educate the public about Lincoln's life in Indiana will help people embrace him as part of the state's history.
What we try to do here is get people to think of him in different terms, personalizing a little bit. Think of him as a young boy, and to learn about these experiences that he was having and to help them kind of understand how those experiences shaped him.
At the memorial, there are five sculpted panels carved in stone, celebrating the different chapters of the president's life, from Kentucky all the way to Washington. On the Indiana panel, Lincoln stands as a young man, not yet the president people remember him as. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Sophia Salaby.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us. Tomorrow on the program, we'll get an update on Gary's Art House Culinary Incubator.